Good morning and welcome to this month's Hancock and Whitney Bank's Economic Update Call. Hancock Bank and Whitney Bank provide this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or its affiliates. If you have any questions during the call, please email them to david.lundgren@hancockbank.com. Today on the call, we have Chief Investment Officer John Portwood and Investment Directors David Lundgren, Luther McDougall, and Jeffrey Tangus. I'll pass it on to the moderator, David Lundgren.
Thank you, Ashley, and good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining us once again for our monthly economic update call. Johnny there, good morning.
Yes, good morning. I'm here.
Well, I think an obvious starting point is same place we started last month. It's the Russia-Ukraine situation continues to, I don't even know if you'd say escalate, but the tensions are still there and the concern is still there. So if you could maybe bring us up to date on where things stand.
Yeah, the last time we talked about this, we indicated that Putin would probably get his way at least for a while. That seemed to be the way things were going, and I guess probably ultimately, unless something really changes, that may still be the case. But in any event, the Ukrainians are trying to gain control, I guess, of some of the major centers that have been taken over by pro-Russian groups. And there have been some incidents recently that give you the impression that things might be escalating a bit. A helicopter was reported to be shot down the other day, and there's a lot more fighting going on around the country. Something else that has happened recently concerning the Baltic states in that region, the Eastern European generally, are becoming more concerned and are, getting assurances from NATO that if, they fall into situations where Russians are infiltrating and they're attacked or whatever, that we'll stand by them, which is something, a bit unusual. We haven't seen that sort of thing since the Cold War, but Latvia, Estonia, Moldova have ethnic Russian populations that are somewhere in the range of, I think, 20% to 30%, and it's thought that possibly might lead to some disruption there, but this thing is continuing. It doesn't seem to be near an end, and I guess in a sense, we could probably call it a new version of the Cold War. One of the interesting things about this is how much the current analysis is focusing on Russian history generally and how this appears to be a normal reaction of Russian politicians and Russians in general when they feel threatened or constrained by states on their borders. And, I guess it goes back, in history many, many years to all the invasions they've suffered over time. But, the basic theory here is that Putin is just following the typical Russian imperative, which is control the states on your border and then project power beyond the states on your border to make sure that you're safe from encroachment by the West. And some analysts recently have talked about the fact that Putin may be actually involved in pulling back financially by protecting Russian finances and bringing money home to Russia and doing some more screening of the Internet to keep the Russians, socially in the dark so that they're not corrupted by Western influences. But according to some recent reports I saw, Russian opinion and Putin's standing among the Russians has skyrocketed recently. So this must be, something that hits home with the Russians. So, I guess we're just going to have to deal with this for quite some time.
John, you mentioned in your initial comments that, that Putin would get his way. And does that mean just eastern Ukraine, or Crimea step one, eastern Ukraine step two, and then the rest of the country step three? What do you think his ultimate goal is?
Getting his way, I guess, it covers a lot of potential outcomes. My guess is it's not outright occupation of the Ukraine, but let's just say a controlling interest. That would be what I would guess. I imagine if they moved into Ukraine in force and the army actually invaded, that would create you know, a fairly sizable reaction of some kind on the part of the West, but probably to the point of the Ukraine becoming something of a satellite state, I guess, of Russia, or where Russian influence, you know, pretty much control what goes on within the country, and that goes back to the to part of my reason for thinking that is what the European reaction has been, which is basically we don't want to rock the boat, and we like getting the Russian gas and oil that's being delivered to us because we don't have any other sources of that at present. And I guess, you know, we're probably squeezing them to some degree to get them to put more pressure on the Russians to back off. But, you know, that may have mixed results. I guess from an economic standpoint, to take this a step or two further, and what that might do to trade in Europe, and I guess it's already having some impact. We just don't really see all of the numbers yet. But to give you an idea of one state, Poland, 20% of Poland's exports go to Russia and the Ukraine. So to the extent that that's disrupted over time, that's going to have a negative effect on Poland. And, you know, you probably have similar relationships with, you know, Latvia, Estonia, and, you know, some of the other countries right there on the border. So, you know, certainly that would have some impact on trade. And to the extent that we continue to push the Russians by imposing different sanctions, and the Russians perhaps impose sanctions of their own and, you know, squeeze the flow of gas to Europe, I suppose, you know, that could, create even more disruption from an economic standpoint. But at this point, you know, I guess the markets don't really care that much about it and consider it be something that will just be there and sort of fester for a while and not get any worse. But obviously, you know, the longer this sort of thing goes on, you know, the more impact it's going to have economically.
So I guess to make sure I'm clear, you would define the disruption currently as not necessarily material to the U.S. economy and the world economy.
Yeah.
Kind of an isolated part of the world that we're looking at, but longer term, if this continues, you could see a bigger impact. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, that would be pretty accurate. I mean, it's having an impact now, but it's relatively minor, and it's more of a nuisance, I guess. You know, if it escalated, of course, it could get much more serious. But if it continues for a long period of time, then, you know, obviously, just like going back to the days of the Cold War, it's going to have some sort of an impact on economic growth worldwide.
Okay, let's shift gears and talk specifically about the U.S. economy. And I guess there was, you know, somewhat of a surprise at the, I guess we have two more revisions to go on first quarter real GDP. Much weaker number than expected. I know a lot of it was probably weather-related, just barely positive. I think the number was 0.1%, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that? Is it just kind of anomaly, weather-related event, or are we starting to see some weakness? And where are we now?
Part of it was weather-related, but such a broad swath of the GDP calculations were negative in that it probably was more than the weather. The only positive thing that came out of that first quarter initial report was the fact that consumer spending on services was higher than expected, but unfortunately the consumer spending number that I'm talking about was for utilities and healthcare and things like that. It was non-discretionary kind of spending, which, you know, just something that people had to do, food, you know, that type of thing. So, you know, it was a pretty weak quarter. The initial estimates, I guess, prior to the announcement were like 1.5, maybe that, and it was expected to be a weak quarter to some degree because of the weather related events, but turned out to be much weaker than expected. Year over year, looking at this first estimate, the trend is 2.3% GDP growth, which is kind of at potential, I guess, if you consider what everybody thinks is going on economically at the current time. Leading indicators currently, though, are still positive, you know, suggesting that recession is not an immediate threat. But it does indicate that we're still probably in an economic environment that's relatively slow by past recovery standards, and probably, I guess, prone to shocks that, more prone to shocks, I guess, that might occur unexpectedly than we've seen in the past. Something else that's kind of interesting going on now, housing has always been considered a driver of economic recovery. At least it often has been since World War II, but, not so much this time. And, a lot of emphasis has been placed in recent years on the Case-Shiller Price Index, which showed prices improving, which certainly was the case, particularly in places like Florida, Nevada, California, that, saw price declines of 50% in some areas. But what was left out of that equation, and something that Shiller himself brought up from time to time, although people didn't like for him to really say it, was that the normal housing environment or the normal market where, a family goes out and they buy a house and they get a mortgage and, they pay on the mortgage and they live in the house, not much of that was going on for the last several years. Most of the purchases, or at least probably anywhere from a third to a half, depending on which study you see, were for cash for investment purposes. And in the last 6 or 7 months, it's become clear that, that particular driver of home buying and housing industry is tapering off pretty rapidly, and the affordability measures are not what they used to be. So now we're back to a market that depends more on first-time buyers than, driving the move-up market and that sort of thing, and there's just not a lot of demand there. So we're back to, a relatively, I guess, weak housing market that's not likely, historically speaking, that's not likely to contribute a great deal to economic growth going forward. So it still looks like we're in, a relatively slow growth environment. And that's probably the story, I suppose. There's not a lot else out there. Oh, wait, let me mention one thing. You're talking about what's happening currently. When we look at the coincident indicators that we follow to get an idea of what's happening from week to week and month to month without, waiting for leading economic indicators to come out or GDP announcements, they look okay. They don't look like they're strengthening particularly compared to what has happened since the recession, but they're still operating in a positive mode. So again, just another indicator that suggests recession is probably not around the corner.
Okay, I want to get your comments on the stock market, but before you do that, Luther's going to share some information on the month and where we stand year to date. Go ahead, Luther.
Last month was a fairly typical month in return in the stock market as far as how the different sectors fared versus each other. Overall, the S&P 500 for the month of April was up 0.8%. And it seems this year that one of the themes has been high yield stocks, and that's evident in the returns for last month, where energy was up 5%, utilities 4%, and consumer staples almost up 3%. The weakest areas in the market were financials, consumer discretionary, and healthcare, all negative. So it was pretty much a mixed bag for the month of April. Year to date, the disparity between the sectors is even more pronounced. A total of 18% between the best performing sector and the worst performing sector. Once again, the focus on high yields is evident. The utilities are up 14.5% year-to-date, energy up 6%, healthcare up 5%. All other sectors were positive or are positive for the year-to-date except for the consumer discretionary sector, which is minus 4%. A lot of this concern about growth of the economy and where we're going, and specifically consumer spending. So those stocks have been relatively weak, and the more stable companies have done fairly well, but a pretty much of a very mixed bag both for the month and the year to date.
I guess another some interesting numbers on the month. While the S&P 500 was up slightly at 0.8%, if you look at the S&P 500 on an equal weighted basis, it was just barely above zero. And then small caps were actually down pretty significantly, as were mid caps. So you really, you had one segment of the market, the kind of the mega caps that really did well, everything else not so much. And John, you know, during the month, we had a bit of a pullback. I think at one point the S&P 500 was down about 3% in the middle of April, only to rebound and get to either new or near market highs for most U.S. market indices. As we've talked on this call really for about a year now, you've been pretty cautious about stocks. But a couple things. What do you think continues to drive stocks and maybe, you know, give us your outlook on where we go from here?
Well, you know, I guess looking at the market currently, like what's driving stocks currently, I suppose, is the idea that there is no alternative. I imagine there are probably a good many investors who look at current yields on bonds and don't see anything very attractive there. You know, that particular idea or psychological bent that, you know, equities probably are the only game in town has, you know, regardless of valuation, is probably, you know, has something to do with that. I mean, the Fed is still easy, of course. They're tapering to some degree, but, you know, there's plenty of money out there to, you know, to fuel a market advance. Margin debt is still pretty high, indicating people are still probably borrowing money to buy equities and so forth and so on. There has been, obviously, from, you know, your comments and what Luther said, a more defensive tone to the markets so far this year because of what's happening to, you know, utilities, the staples, the more defensive areas. There's a more defensive, you know, tone beginning. You know, obviously, you know, we got here from 2009 because of an improvement in earnings and more significantly, a significant improvement in profit margins. And unfortunately, again, getting back to, I guess, some valuation stories here and what has happened in the last 4 or 5 years, profit margins are elevated, and profit margins historically have been one of these mean reverting series in finance, which means they get high for a while, and then they taper off and get high for a while, and then taper off again. And so, you know, they're extraordinarily high at this point, and, you know, the thinking is that it won't be long before they begin to, you know, I guess revert to the mean and take some of the bloom off the rose, I guess, so to speak, as far as earnings are concerned. But, you know, we've come a long way since 2009 when, you know, the valuation numbers were pretty cheap. The market's gone up 20% a year annualized, I think, Dave, right, for the last 5 years. I might mention here that Dave is publishing a short piece in a few days that looks specifically at five-year moves over time in the market. And 20% annualized moves for 5 years are relatively rare. And often they begin from periods of significant undervaluation. And if they move very quickly, you end up in periods of somewhat overvaluation. And you just don't get too many periods like that that last, you know, more than 5 years. So just looking at that by itself suggests that we probably, you know, have some backing and filling to do for some time before we have another run of that magnitude. But again, the, you know, valuation situation now is relatively poor compared to where it was 5 years ago, and, you know, expected returns are relatively low, better than bonds, but relatively low compared to history. So normally when you get into periods like this, you end up with more volatile markets compared to, you know, the more immediate period, and that's probably what we're looking at now, more volatile periods. And relatively for the major market indices, for example, you know, lower returns out 5 and 10 years, again, you know, based on some of these historic valuation numbers. Now, you know, that doesn't mean that every industry and every stock and every sector is going to have similar returns, but it does suggest that, you know, a great deal more selection, you know, should be, you know, used, you know, in making stock investments at this point than was the case, say, you know, say 5 years ago. But anyway, you know, we're in a situation where more selection is required, perhaps unless someone is very attuned toward a long-term return and can handle a lot of volatility and doesn't mind being 100% invested in equities, for example. That's fine. you know, if your particular personal psychology is more risk averse than that, then perhaps you should think about a more balanced approach. And as Dave mentioned, and we may have talked before on this call, we have reduced equity several times in the last year, and our present position on for a balanced portfolio is slightly below neutral. I mean, we're not exactly, you know, bearishly positioned at this point, but in recognition of change in valuation over the last 5 years, you know, we're a little bit more cautious than we used to be. So, you know, my only message at this point is not to suggest to people that they need to be out of stocks entirely, but that they need to very carefully examine their ability to withstand more volatility than we've seen in the past 5 years going forward, you know, and perhaps, you know, adjust their expectations and if necessary, maybe adjust their asset mix accordingly.
And, John, just, you know, to clarify that point, we've been through an incredible five-year period, as you've mentioned, you know, above 20% annualized returns with very little volatility. And your comments about valuation shouldn't necessarily be interpreted as, you know, we're anticipating a severe market pullback. Your concerns about valuation only suggest that the probabilities above average returns over the next, say, 5 to 10 years have been somewhat reduced. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you never really know, you know, what particular, you know, event or circumstance, you know, might cause the markets to, you know, drop suddenly. You know, obviously something that happens in Europe, if it's significantly serious, you know, could cause the market to take a hit, so to speak. But at valuation levels that exist today, the shock absorber is just not there. You know, if stocks were really cheap, then a lot of bad things can happen, and the market doesn't really suffer that much in the near term. But when markets are relatively expensive, you have to be, I guess, mentally prepared for the unusual event that would cause much more volatility than would be the case if the market was cheap. So, you know that's the only issue about where we are today. I mean, the good news is that inflation is low and interest rates are low, and if that situation remains the same, you know, then it's entirely possible that, you know, even with relatively slow economic growth and slow earnings growth, you know, that, you know, any volatility going forward might be fairly constrained. It's a different story if interest rates rise a lot or if inflation rises a lot. You know, then we got a lot more market volatility. But what Dave says is correct. I mean, it's, you know, when valuation is extraordinarily good as it was 5 years ago, you know, you can take more risk. When valuation is relatively high as it is today, depending again on your particular risk, you know, personality, you can't take quite as much risk unless you're willing to live through a lot of, you know, potential volatility over time. So all of this is based on probabilities and not certainties. I mean, there's no precision in this business. You simply have to, you know, make some judgments based on, you know, how things cycle over time, and just be aware of when things appear to be, you know, I guess extraordinarily cheap or maybe not so cheap. And right now we're in a situation where things are just not so cheap.
Okay. Thank you. We're going to spend the last few minutes here maybe talking about the Fed and the bond market. Luther, I think you're going to take the lead, and Jeff is going to chime in as needed. And let's, you know, one thing John didn't talk about, you know, and potential impact on stocks and, of course, bonds is action by the Fed. So maybe bring us up to date on what's happened the last few weeks in terms of Fed policy or Fed action, if anything.
All right. Last month, the Fed really had little impact on the market, only for the reason that they didn't meet until the last day of the month. However, if one looks at the side-by-side statements from the Fed, there were some noticeable differences, and there were also some phrases in the statements that carried over from both. Back in March when the Fed met, one of the opening sentences said growth and economic activity slowed during the winter months, which we've already talked about. In the April meeting, they had a little bit something different to say, and that was that growth and economic activity has picked up recently. They don't go into detail about how much, but at least things have picked up, and they also stated that household spending appears to be rising more quickly. So apparently the Fed and some of the market indicators or the economic indicators out there are pointing to things maybe picking up again, but this has happened before, and we may slip back in to slower growth again. But in the April meeting, the Fed did have some positive things to say. One of the things that did not change between the two meetings and has been in there for a while is that from the report, it says to support continued progress toward maximum employment and price stability, the committee today reaffirms its view that a highly accommodative stance for monetary policy remains appropriate. So the Fed is going to keep interest rates low for a long period of time, even though in the April meeting they also announced that they will continue to taper their bond purchases, going down from $55 billion in March to $45 billion in April. And that should continue as we go forward with additional Fed meetings. So it was a relatively benign month for the Fed, a few changes in the statement, but it didn't really impact April returns because the meeting was on the last day of the month. As far as interest rates, exactly what I said happened. If you look at the 10-year Treasury for the month of April, we started at 272 and we ended at 265. So about a 7-basis-point decline. You really saw more of a decline on the longer-term treasuries with the 10-year dropping by about 7 basis points and the 30-year dropping 10 basis points, but still not a whole lot of movement across the curve. On a year-to-date basis, because we did have weak economic growth, because we have concerns or the market has concerns about where the stock market is, because of what's happening in Russia and elsewhere, interest rates have fallen. The 10-year yield at the beginning of the year was just slightly above 3% at 3.029%. And as I mentioned, at the end of the month of April, it was at 2.6%. So we saw the 10-year drop by almost 40 basis points, and we've seen the 30-year Treasury drop even further. I think part of that is the concerns about what's going on in Europe and elsewhere. Part of it is the concern that that the economy is not picking up to the extent that some people had anticipated. And part of it is that people would rather be in bonds than stocks. So we have seen interest rates decline a little bit this year, move more by the economy probably than anything else.
Jeff, anything you want to add from a bond market Fed perspective?
Yeah, Dave, I'd like to make one point, and that is sort of pull together what Luther just said and juxtapose to what John said, and that is if you have a Treasury 10-year at 2.6%, at the same time when you have a stock market where the vast majority of market strategists and economists out there are forecasting on a forward-looking basis, somewhere around a 3% growth rate, that doesn't jive. That's a contradiction. And there's been a fair amount written lately about this, in that the bond market is giving us a completely different signal, it seems, than the stock market. And that's certainly not unprecedented in terms of the markets, but it's telling you it's telling you there's a contradiction there, and that at some point that will have to be resolved. Either the bond market is right, the stock and yields will have to move higher on the 10-year, either the stock market is correct and yields will have to move higher, or the bond market is correct and stocks will have to give up some ground, or perhaps the third, which is somewhere in the middle, that perhaps rates have to move a little higher and the stock market basically just treads water for a while in that the economy isn't as good as a lot of economists think. And I think that's probably the more likely scenario, that the truth lies somewhere in between. But I just point out that there is a distinct contradiction between what generally the stock market is saying and what the bond market is saying.
Okay. Well, thank you, Jeff, and thank you, everybody, who participated today, and thank you to all our listeners, and we look forward to speaking with everyone again in June. Thank you.